You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette, and it's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is, of course, when we get you updated on the news that made headlines this last week. And today, our panel includes Betsy Russell, the Boise Bureau Chief at the Idaho Press and the voice of the Eye on Boise blog, Margaret Carmel, senior reporter with BoiseDev.com, Kelsey Mosley Morris with the Idaho Capital Sun. And we want to welcome Nate Eaton. He is news director at EastIdahoNews.com. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday. Thank you. Good to be here.
Okay, so I want to start with the legislature because there's so much going on. So, Betsy, we touched on this during our roundtable last week, but there's been some movement since then. Can you fill us in on what some critics are calling potential voter suppression laws?
Yeah, actually, a lot of critics are calling them that.
And yeah.
I fully expected these two bills that came out of committee this week to come up for debate today on the floor of the House. They did not. The House has now adjourned until Monday. Otherwise, you'd be hearing a lot of background noise right now because I'm still down at the State House. But these two bills, one of them is to target what its sponsor called, quote, gaming the system. This has to do with unaffiliated voters. Under current law, unaffiliated voters can affiliate, register with a party, become a registered Republican or Democrat or Libertarian or whatever, right at the polls on election day. If someone is already affiliated with a party, they have to switch by the end of the candidate filing period, which is quite a long time before the May 17th primary this year. That's March 11th. This bill would subject unaffiliated voters to the same deadline to change as those who are already affiliated. And the reason that's a big deal is that more than 310,000 registered Idaho voters are registered as unaffiliated. That's about a third of Idaho's registered voters. A whole lot of people choose not to affiliate with a party in Idaho. And in fact, we didn't used to have registration by party, but then the Idaho Republican Party filed a federal lawsuit in an attempt to close its party primary to anyone other than registered Republicans, and they won. And so now we do have a closed Republican primary where the only people who are allowed to cast ballots are those who are affiliated with the Republican Party. The Democratic Party has maintained an open primary, so even people who are affiliated with other parties or not affiliated can vote in that one. But of course, all the contests in this very Republican state are on the Republican side. And so the interesting thing about this bill is it would change the deadline right now for this May's primary. And it would mean that a whole lot of unaffiliated voters who might otherwise choose on election day to cast ballots in that those hotly contested races in the Republican primary would be turned away, could not do that, could not vote in those races. That bill has cleared committee, and it is headed for a vote and debate in the full House. There's also another bill that came out of committee on the exact same day. They're one after another on the House's agenda, and they likely will come up for debate and vote on Monday morning. And this is a bill from Representative Mike Moyle targeting a practice that he calls ballot harvesting. And he proposed legislation on this last year. It didn't end up passing both houses. This is a new version of the same thing, but basically it's aimed at a concern that someone is nefariously gathering up people's absentee ballots for partisan reasons and delivering them to the polls or the mail. So it would make it a crime, a felony in some cases, to have somebody else's absentee ballot or take it to the mailbox or the post office or the ballot drop box. And this has raised really big concerns from voting rights advocates, particularly for people, say, in assisted living facilities or hospice care, things like that. The bill allows some exceptions, some very limited exceptions for specific relatives, for example. But if the person caring for you in an assisted living facility is not your relative, they can't take your ballot under this bill. They would be a felon. Wow. So that bill is also headed out to the House floor. And Representative Doug Aconowitz, who's the sponsor of the unaffiliated voters bill, says he thinks the only reason why any voter might remain unaffiliated with a party is because they're gaming the system. They want to switch at the last minute to vote in a different party's primary that they don't agree with in order to pick the weaker candidate and then unaffiliate right after the election. And certainly that's legal right now. But actually in Idaho, we have a long, long tradition of people not wanting to call themselves party members, not wanting to affiliate with any political party. And this would put them at a distinct disadvantage in Maine.
Yeah, absolutely. Betsy, I'd also like you to, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I just wanted to add that unaffiliated voter bill is one of the zombie bills of this session, where it had an original sponsor, Representative Troy, at the beginning of the session, and she dropped it because I don't know. She didn't give a reason, but it sounds like she didn't agree with it ultimately. And she told me that it was dead. And then it came back with a different sponsor. So it'll be interesting to see how it fares on the floor and if one of its original sponsors ends up voting against it.
Yeah, that bill was widely reported to be dead. And as Kelsey said, it's a zombie. It's back.
Wow. Yeah, it's not going away. Betsy, there's an anti-abortion bill that cleared the Senate. Talk to us about that.
Well, it came out of committee in the Senate after a very long and very heated hearing. Nearly two dozen people testified for or against that bill. And when you read the bill, all that it does, it takes Idaho's existing law, which isn't in effect yet because it had a trigger provision saying it wouldn't take effect until some other state had a similar law upheld. And it adds, and that was a bill that passed last year to forbid abortions after a fetal heartbeat can be detected, which is somewhere around 5 or 6 weeks of gestation, often before most women know that they're pregnant. So this bill adds a Texas style provision, allowing an enforcement provision where relatives of the woman who had the abortion could sue the doctor. And it specifically says that the aunt, uncle, father, grandparent, or sibling of the aborted fetus could file a lawsuit up to 4 years after the abortion and get minimum damages of $20,000. And this is for any abortion that occurs after 6 weeks. And all kinds of legal and constitutional problems have been raised about this particular bill, which kind of adds on to the anti-abortion provisions we already have on the books in Idaho. Idaho already has what's called a trigger law that says if Roe versus Wade is overturned, abortion will become a felony in Idaho. The only exemptions are for to save the life of the mother or for cases of rape or incest that have been officially reported to the police. That law's already on the books. This stacks another one on top of it in a way that, according to an Idaho Attorney General's opinion, clearly conflicts with the Idaho Constitution as far as this lawsuit enforcement thing. Nevertheless, despite all those issues and problems, the committee passed it, I believe, on a party line vote, and it's headed out to the Senate with a whole bunch of co-sponsors.
Okay. Margaret, give us some background on Interfaith Sanctuary, because there has been tremendous controversy around it trying to move locations. But now the city of Boise is going to be taking up an appeal around this.
Yes. So this topic has been raging for a year now, and I think we likely have many more months of debate to go. So Interfaith Sanctuary in January of 2021, they said that they were going to purchase the Salvation Army, former Salvation Army warehouse on State Street in the Veterans Park Neighborhood Association. They were going to move their shelter over and expand it, have separate wings for elderly people who need medical care, medically fragile folks who need medical care, a family wing, some low barrier, beds for anybody to sleep in on an emergency basis, a day shelter. And this effort was immediately opposed by the neighbors, who have a whole slew of objections to it. They say that it's going to make their neighborhood more unsafe, more crime. They basically say that an emergency shelter does not belong this close to a residential neighborhood. And it went before planning and zoning. There were some delays over the summer where the mayor wanted to have a task force to study the location, but then that task force decided that they were not going to give a recommendation on a location for the shelter. And it went to planning and zoning. And planning and zoning turned it down. All but one planning and zoning commissioner voted against it. They said that that the project would impact safety, and there was no way that that the project could say it wouldn't have adverse impacts on the safety of the neighborhood. And now it's been appealed by Interfaith Sanctuary. And so Boise City Council is going to hear it. And if you remember this planning and zoning controversy from a couple months ago, it was not one and done. There were 12 hours total of testimony, questions, discussions over the course of multiple meetings. There was also a lengthy deliberation period. And so in, and so what that did is, because once you open a public hearing, you can't close it and then reopen it to go hear other matters. So it essentially created this massive roadblock where all of these other applications started piling up behind planning and zoning, because they took 3.5 meetings to decide to make their decision. So in order to address that, the city council is going to have hearings over the course of a whole week. They have blocked out hours and hours of time on April 18th, April 19th, April 20th, April 21st, and April 25th, wow, if they need it. So, and anyone who would like to testify on this project, the only way you can testify on it is if you testified at planning and zoning and you're considered a party of record. So that's another reason why we saw this whole slew of people wanting to speak at planning and zoning, because they wanted to basically get the approval to speak at city council. But wait, there's more. It is very, very likely that no matter what city council decides, yes, no, whatever, this is going to get filed in fourth district court for a judicial review. So it is very likely that what we're going to see happen is that if the shelter, whether it's approved by city council or not approved, someone on the losing side is going to take that to court and ask a judge to make their decision. And those decisions, that's not a quick thing. That is not, you can call up a judge and say, hey, can you tell me your thoughts on this real quick so we can get this, year-long matter resolved? No. That is a lengthy process that's going to involve arguments. It's going to take some time, and that adds more time. And so just as the fact that this was an election issue in the 2021 race, it is very real that this might be an election issue in the 2023 race.
Wow.
So, you know, stay tuned. We're going to be on this roller coaster for a long time.
I was going to say, buckle up. Hey, Nate, before we take a break, a while back, there was a sheriff over in East Idaho who, if I'm remembering correctly, pulled a gun on a group of teenagers. He is facing charges. He won't resign. Would you give us some background on this and what's actually happening in his criminal case right now?
Yeah, this happened around Thanksgiving time. Some members of a church group, young women with their leaders, were leaving Thanksgiving turkey cards, like gratitude cards, on people's doorsteps, and they were taping them to the door and then running, as like a little act of kindness. And they went to the sheriff's house, who goes to their church, left the turkey, and the sheriff, I guess you could say, flipped out, came and held a gun to the leader's throat, her head, and said, "You need to get out of the car." This, according to court documents and other witnesses that we spoke with. And the young women were scared to death. He was threatening them, saying all sorts of stuff. And he was ultimately charged and has not stepped down. The attorney general is handling this case because of a conflict of interest with the county prosecutor. And many have called for him to resign and step down, but he is not. In fact, he was supposed to have a preliminary hearing. It's been pushed off several times now. And now we're looking at mid-March for it. The attorney general is saying, let's get this process done. Let's get this going. And his attorney saying that he has conflict. So it's an interesting case. He did have to turn in his gun, so he doesn't have access to a weapon, but he is still the county sheriff. We don't know if he's actually going to work every day. Any communication from the sheriff's office has been coming from his chief deputy as far as other stories or concerns or other cases. But this will be an interesting one, especially if he takes it all the way to a jury trial, because we understand that there's doorbell footage that caught this whole thing on tape and several witnesses that went through this entire thing.
Well, I mean, this made national headlines, Nate, when this happened, because it was so shocking.
Yeah, it was. And the sheriff, it's interesting what he has told investigators is that he wasn't quite sure what he what went wrong with him. The other thing that got him into a bit of trouble is that when he was speaking with investigators, he told them that he lives near the Fort Hall Reservation, and he used some derogatory language in describing Native Americans from Fort Hall and saying that they caused problems. And it just was not the best. And then the Fort Hall Reservation, the leaders came out and called for him to resign, called for the sheriff's resignation. The prosecutor called for it. Several other people have called for it. He's remaining firm, still in office, still getting paid, not having a weapon, and fighting these charges, even though the you know, the evidence doesn't look very favorable on his behalf.
Yeah, so we'll have to wait then until March for a hearing. Margaret, some major news coming from Meta, which formerly known as Facebook, building a facility in the Treasure Valley.
That's correct. This news broke earlier this week, caused a lot of waves. So Meta, which is the parent company for Facebook, is going to invest $800 million and build a data center in the far eastern edge of CUNA and an industrial park, which is owned by the Gardner Company. So this project is super interesting because 2 years ago, Governor Brad Little signed a bill that provided a pretty big tax break to tech companies that want to build data centers. And it was sort of alluded to earlier this week that this was an effort in this long-running campaign to recruit a data center like Meta to come here. So now they've got this tax break. The data center is going to come here. And I'm going to be curious what the impact is, because at its peak, the data center says they're going to create 1,200 construction jobs, but then once it's operational, it will only employ 100 people day to day. And I asked Meta, I did a follow-up story on our website, boisedev.com. I asked Meta, okay, can you tell me how many, like what sort of jobs are these all high-tech engineers making $150,000 a year? Or more, are these, you know, security guards making just a little over minimum wage? What does this look like? And they were very mum on the details. They basically told me, we're going to hire a lot of different people, technicians, security guards, culinary specialists, HV techs or HVAC techs. So it's kind of unclear exactly what these jobs will be and how many of them will actually be really high paying. Which high paying jobs create economic growth, because then if you make a lot of money, then you're going to go out to dinner more, you're going to go take your family to the movies more, and that sort of generates that economic engine. So, and then there's the question of water. And a lot of people don't realize this, but data centers are a massive suck on water resources. They use a lot of water to circulate through the building and keep the servers cool. And whenever Meta announced, part of their announcement was they said they were going to bring more water to the Treasure Valley than they use. This is part of Meta's initiative to be quote unquote water positive by 2030. But at the time, they provided no details on what that sort of, how they're going to accomplish this, what that project's going to look like, all of that stuff. So I asked the Idaho Department of Environmental Quality, and they didn't know anything about this. They had no application, no idea, none. So I asked Meta, I said, can I get some more details? And they just linked me to a blog post that talked about how important water resources are and their efforts to be water positive, but it included no details on the CUNA project. And they've collaborated with other local governments around the West to do some water quality and projects, wetland restorations. They gave some funding to help this lake in Arizona, which has had declining water levels. But it's super unclear exactly what they're going to do. So there's a lot of fanfare around this project, and certainly it's going to be $800 million, you know, being taxable by the city of CUNA. That's, you know, not insignificant, but I think there's a lot of fanfare and still a lot of questions about just how big of a fish did we land, and what is going to be the impact on our water resources, given the fact that we're in a high desert that's rapidly growing and in a drought.
Yeah, no, good points there, Margaret. Kelsey, you know, we know that there are worker shortages everywhere these days, and Idaho is feeling that as well. So tell us about this idea that some say could help, and it has to do with minors serving alcohol.
Yeah, this was an interesting one. First of all, I have to just say that the term water positive kind of makes me laugh.
Me too, actually. I hadn't either.
It makes me laugh. But on the minors front, this came from the Idaho Retailers Association. Pam Eaton is the executive director, and she came to the Idaho legislature last week, I think it was. It just passed, that bill passed the Senate unanimously, or not unanimously, by 30 votes yesterday, I think it was. But it came last week, and she said, you know, a lot of legislators have come to them and said, how can we help your industry during this difficult time? We know you've been hit really hard by everything that's going on. So what can we do? And she would give them a list, and they would say, well, what can we do that doesn't cost money? And that's easy. And so she said, this was one thing that they could do that would help with the labor shortage, because as they've been trying to recruit people and failing, the one group that they are able to get is teenagers. But a lot of these retail establishments that serve alcohol, they can't do it with a teenager who's 19. The teenager has to be 19 or older.
Right.
And that is kind of a little bit older than most states require. I think 26 states or so require it to be 18 or older. And one other state, which is Maine, requires 17 and older. And so this would put Idaho in line with Maine and make it 17. And she'd actually said that they were thinking about making it 16, but they thought that the legislature would go for 17 more easily. So that would just make it so that they could serve it to patrons, and, you know, it would be up to the establishment if they even wanted to let 17-year-olds do that. But it's definitely something that I think will be interesting to see how it fares in the House, because I think a lot of people feel more comfortable with 18-year-olds doing it, or 19-year-olds versus 17. So it's an interesting proposal.
Yeah, absolutely. So Nate, there's some issues over in Eastern Idaho when it comes to not having enough deputies, in particular in jails.
Yeah, this kind of goes along with Kelsey's story, and the stories probably all of us have covered as far as finding workers. The issue is that there's shortages in these jails, and the inmate population is not necessarily going down, because a lot of times these jailers will get hired and not realize that they have to do tasks like, you know, helping an inmate get dressed, or helping an inmate take a shower, or basically helping an inmate function day to day without having serious issues. And so it's an issue that has been around for a while now, but with the worker shortage and with the economy the way that it is, a lot of these jailers are just leaving the industry altogether and saying, I can go somewhere else, I can make more money and not deal with the circumstances that we're in. However, the Madison County Jail in Rexburg says they're not having this issue, because they're trying a program where if you come in and you work at the jail, after X amount of months or a certain amount of time, you can apply to become a deputy. You can transition into working on the road in patrol and thus advancing your career. They have a staff of jail reserve officers who might pick up one or two shifts a month and go in and work in the jail just part-time to make some extra money, who have been trained. And so they're trying to figure a way around this shortage so that they aren't hit as hard as some of these other jurisdictions. It's particularly bad in the Pocatello area, where they need a new jail anyway. That's a whole nother issue. They've been trying to bond to get a new jail because of the number of inmates. But you know, it's an issue I would imagine that several law enforcement agencies are dealing with statewide.
Well, it's interesting to see what Madison County is doing in that regard. Betsy, I want to head back to the State House for a minute, because we've seen in the last couple of years monuments, mostly Confederate, that have been taken down in parts of the country. So how is our legislature reacting to this?
Well, there was a bill that was proposed last year that was extremely far-reaching, that it would have required the legislature to approve before any local monument of any kind could be taken down, or any street could be renamed, or a school could be renamed. if there was anything historic about the original name. And that bill did not pass both houses. Well, now we have a new version. And this week it passed the House on a 44-24 vote. This time, instead of having the legislature itself weigh in, it would require any of those local decisions to permanently move a historical monument or change the name of a park or a bridge or a school. They left out streets this time. And that permission from the state would have to come through a 2/3 approval from the board of the Idaho State Historical Society. Now, the Idaho State Historical Society board only meets quarterly. So this could pose some problems for local city councils or school boards. Let's say they want to dedicate their school in honor of someone, you know, who's a local hero. They would conceivably have to wait a long time to get state permission. There was a lot of debate in the House when they debated this about local control. And why would the state be telling local elected officials they have to get permission from an unelected group at the Historical Society before doing something that their constituents want them to do that regards spending local taxpayer money that they're in charge of? Nevertheless, the House passed the bill and sent it over to the Senate side where it faces an uncertain future. But this is the latest in a long string of decisions at the legislative level in overriding local control and basically suggesting that local governments don't really know what they're doing and they need the state to tell them how to do stuff right. So we saw that vote this week.
All right. Well, I wonder how the Historical Society feels about this. But
Also, the bill includes a specific clause that says the legislature can require members of the Historical Society board to come before the legislature to testify to defend their decisions. Oh, I bet they're just really looking forward to that.
Oh, I bet they are. You know, marking their calendars for that one. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll have more with our reporter roundtable next. And continuing with our reporter roundtable, Betsy Russell with Idaho Press, Margaret Carmel with BoiseDev.com, Kelsey Mosley Morris with Idaho Capital Sun, and Nate Eaton with EastIdahoNews.com. So, Betsy, last year, Idaho legislators wanted to ban Powerball. They've apparently changed their tune this year.
Same committee that last year killed a bill that was aimed at allowing Powerball to continue in Idaho. And Powerball is a multi-state lottery game. It's one of three that the Idaho Lottery offers. It's the one with the really big jackpots. We had a guy from Star a number of years ago win $220 million on Powerball. And the thing is, Powerball is run by this multi-state group. It also includes provinces in Canada. And they have been planning to expand into parts of Australia and the United Kingdom. And so because the way the current law is written, it only anticipates Idaho Lottery partnering with with multi-state lotteries that are in the US and Canada. The lottery brought a bill saying, you know, lifting that and saying, you know, they could be anywhere. And the House State Affairs Committee pretty much freaked out. And they talked about, well, you know, people in Australia, they support things like gun control. Maybe this lottery that we're a part of will raise money for that. And they raised a lot of other concerns. They killed the bill, even knowing at the time, being told at the time, that that would mean the end of Powerball in Idaho. Well, it turns out we got a reprieve. The negotiations with Australia and the United Kingdom kind of broke down, took longer than they thought. They haven't signed the new contract yet. So a new bill has come back, and this one is much more narrow. It says only that the Idaho Lottery can participate in a multi-state game that includes Australia and the United Kingdom, and it can't expand any further without an affirmative vote of the legislature. So again, we had debate in the same committee, the House State Affairs Committee, but this time they passed the bill. They passed it with no recommendation, as I recall, which is kind of usually they recommend that it do pass, but it got out of committee. And the Powerball game alone generates $15 million a year for Idaho schools. There were people on the committee saying, well, wait a minute, if we take that money away from the schools, where are we going to get that money other than voter approved supplemental property tax levies, which raise people's taxes? And there really was no answer to that.
Well, speaking of taxes, Margaret, there's another bill at the State House that is trying to limit local government budgets, but the hope here is that it would give some property tax relief.
Yes. So this is a kind of a complicated proposal. Hopefully I can make it make sense. So this comes from House Majority Leader Mike Moyle, and he is suggesting that any increase in property tax values, sales tax values over what cities currently get now would have to have half of that amount turned back into property tax relief. So to put that sort of in a number terms, if the city of Boise has a $270 million property tax budget and they get an additional $10 million in sales tax revenue next year, they would have to take $5 million of that and reduce property taxes. So it's still early, but advocates for cities are worried about this bill. They're saying that what could happen is that it wouldn't provide substantial relief because, you know, half of that amount spread over all of these taxpayers, particularly in bigger entities or, you know, bigger organizations like the City of Boise, Nampa, Meridian, would be a drop in the bucket for relief. And then all it would do is just reduce the amount of services that cities can provide, because then, okay, they have to take the $5 million of increased sales tax revenue that they did get and turn it around and fill in probably the gap that they, you know, the gap in services that they would have gotten, that they that was created by not getting the increase. And it could also incentivize cities to increase property taxes more often when they wouldn't otherwise do it, because they know that over time, that increase in sales tax is going to be eaten away. So we'll see what happens with this. And again, put this in the broader context, this is on top of last year's legislation that capped how much cities can increase their property tax collections for new growth. So if a city like the City of Starr, which is rapidly growing, ends up having, you know, 10% growth, 12% growth, which they have had, they can only increase their property tax collections 8% because of this cap. So then on top of it, now, if this bill passes, they couldn't even use extra sales tax money toward building a new fire station, proper, you know, police officers, all these sorts of things. They'd have to turn it back to property tax relief. So it's going to be really interesting to see what happens with this. I'm sure in the hearings, local government officials are going to come out and they're going to show up at the state house and be grumpy about it. And I'm going to be interested to see what legislators have to say.
Margaret, it brings up some of the very same issues that local governments had with House Bill 389 last year. And in particular, those cities that, when we have a lot of growth and our sales tax revenues are growing, that's who's going to get targeted, are those cities that are growing a lot. They're not going to be allowed to expand services to that new growth that presumably is generating more property taxes. So it's an interesting argument.
Yeah, I think so as well. So Kelsey, we are less than 3 months away from Idaho's primary election. What candidates do we know are bringing in some decent amounts of money?
Yeah, I've been following this for several months now, so I can really nerd out on it if you want. but the statewide candidate races are quite a bit hotter than legislative races. I've been following both, but the governor's race in particular obviously is raising the most money. Governor Brad Little has about, probably more than $1.25 million at this point in cash on hand. That is far and away the most of anybody who has cash on hand, and he's spent about $300,000 of it. So he's definitely leading the way in expenditures as well, even though he hasn't officially declared he's in the race.
We're waiting to see if he's going to rerun.
Yeah. He's running ads. He has a campaign manager. Yeah. It's just a formality at this point. But he's spending quite a bit of money on consulting firms. One in particular that's an opposition research firm, which is interesting because his race between himself and Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan is pretty hot. And I'm wondering if that's going to be something we see in a few months, if not sooner. But McGeehan is also spending quite a bit of money on consulting firms. And she spent $100,000 recently on some media buys, I think. She had a really fancy ad out just recently. That was like 2.5 minutes long. And so they're definitely starting to ramp up their spending. And the lieutenant governor race is a little bit more even in terms of its raising and spending, but a lot of that is just promotional campaign literature. And so, yeah, there's been some interesting developments there. There's more than $5 million, I think, so far in the statewide races, which is significant, especially how far out we still are. And the candidate filing period opens up on the 28th for about 2 weeks. So we'll see if anybody else runs in the meantime and how things shift between now and then.
Well, I think with that amount of time and that kind of money, we are probably going to be inundated with,
we sure
with
are.
Ads. We are going to be inundated. All right, let's take one last. Exactly. Let's take one last break. We'll finish up with our roundtable next. And let's jump right back into our reporter roundtable. This week, our panelists are Betsy Russell with the Idaho Press, Margaret Carmel with BoiseDev.com, Kelsey Mosley Morris with the Idaho Capital Sun, and Nate Eaton with EastIdahoNews.com. We know that we are seeing teachers all across the country leave the profession in record numbers, and Idaho is no exception to this. And not only are we seeing then a shortage of teachers, we're also seeing a shortage of substitute teachers. So, Nate, talk to us about this, but also your experience and journey with this.
Yeah, so I had never seen schools cancel schools because there's a shortage of teachers or substitutes. And that's what was happening in several areas in Idaho a few weeks ago with COVID numbers being so high. There was districts canceling all classes. It happened in Bonneville County several times. I know it happened in the Boise area at a few districts. And so we kept, you know, reporting these stories about districts not having enough substitute teachers and there being this shortage. And several districts have passed, you know, emergency ordinances or whatever so that they can pay substitute teachers more and give them incentives to try to recruit them. Because the issue they're finding is that you can make maybe $11 or $12 as a substitute teacher, but go to a fast food restaurant and make $15. And so why would somebody sign up to be a substitute teacher? And so I approached a local district and said, we want to do a story that maybe shows more about what is involved in this. And they said, well, do you want to do a story and shadow a sub or actually be a sub? And I decided to sign up, actually be a substitute teacher. And it took me going online and filling out an application, and I was called into the district office the next day, and I sat down and had about a 10-minute interview, and they asked me what my experience is teaching children, and I said, well, I'm a dad, but I've never taught kids otherwise. How would I handle a disruptive kid in the class? And after that, it was about an hour to 2 hours of online training, watching videos, reading through the district book. And then I was cleared to be a substitute teacher. They did do a background check and they did take my fingerprints. And all in all, it took about 3 or 4 days. And then they put my information into a computer program where I would get a text or an email every time there was a job available. And my phone would not stop buzzing. It was as if every 10 minutes there was a new availability to substitute, either in a Spanish class or a shop class or a special ed class, or the numbers were just, I couldn't believe how many substitutes they needed. And of course, this was at the height of COVID. I'm sure it's calmed down since then. So I signed up to teach first grade as a substitute for just one day.
And God bless you.
Very next day, I went into the classroom, and the teacher had been out for 3 days with COVID. So this was the fourth day the kids were having a different sub. And there's not much structure or you know, stability with that. The teacher had really good substitute plans. And I noticed the teacher across the hall, she was coming in to help me throughout the day. And if had I not showed up, she would have had to take the 20 kids I had. With her 20 kids. So she would have been teaching 40 first graders. That can obviously be quite a task. And I learned that, you know, I was tired at the end of the day. I watching after these 20 kids, and I just, you know, my hat's off to the teachers and the substitutes. And they it really has been so challenging this year with the COVID and with the job shortage the way it is, just trying to get people to sign up. And I believe in in other states, and maybe Betsy would probably know more about this than I would, as far as the governor or the legislator allowing state employees to use some of their time to go substitute teach. I believe that bill passed in Utah. I'm not sure if it's passed here.
Well, I'm curious too, Nate. Are you planning on continuing to sub? I mean, that is, because I agree with you, it takes a special person to not just be a teacher, but I think to teach these younger grades. I mean, honestly, my hats are off to someone that can spend 8 hours a day, 5 days a week with 5, 6, 7 year olds.
Well, and the day, when the day came time for me to go home, I thought, phew, I'm done. But as a teacher, there's always the next day. You've always got to have 7 more hours of planning and grades and papers to grade. I don't know if I will be doing it again. Maybe at the high school level, that would be kind of interesting. But so many of these schools are pulling in even like paraprofessionals, aides that might be hired work in the library. Sorry, you got to take this class today. I know several principals are stepping in to fill the gaps, and there's been janitors that have even filled in to do the gaps. And you don't want a child just sitting in a classroom all day watching movies, watching videos, educational videos. So they're trying to prevent that from doing it. But I think my days of substitute teaching might be limited. I'm kind of busy with my other job, but you know, I might do it occasionally here or there. I have been cleared and I am in the system. So who knows?
Who knows? Well, and I do agree that, I mean, I think if you have school age children, I think we've all seen that where all of our kiddos have had paraprofessionals, substitute teachers when we were at the height of COVID for sure. We only have about 2 minutes left. So Betsy, I do want to wrap up with a report that's raising some questions though about how schools are being funded here in our state.
That's right. The legislature actually commissioned this report from the Office of Performance Evaluations about school facilities, school buildings, and how many of them around our state are not up to par. And the results were actually pretty darn stunning because they found a huge, huge backlog and that the vast majority of Idaho schools are not in good condition. They're in nearly 2/3 are in fair or poor condition. The initial estimate to get all schools up to good condition was $847 million. Wow. The state has not commissioned a statewide facility condition assessment of school buildings since 1993. The report recommended we need to do one of those right now, and we need to come up with a way to fund it. This follows the Idaho Supreme Court having declared our school funding system unconstitutional back in 2005 over the exact same issue, lack of funding for school building construction and repairs, which right now you got to pass a bond issue by a 2/3 vote. There's some limited state aid to school districts, but that's the main way to build a school. And we have not changed that in Idaho. And in fact, the legislature this year is moving to make that harder by the House this week passed a bill to forbid repeat bond issues after one has failed to get the 2/3 mark till 11 months after the last try.
Well, I want to thank all of you for taking your time out of your day to be on our reporter roundtable. Big thanks to Betsy Russell, the Boise Bureau Chief at the Idaho Press and the voice of the Eye on Boise blog, Margaret Carmel, Senior Reporter with BoiseDev.com, Kelsey Mosley-Morris with the Idaho Capital Sun, and Nate Eaton, News Director at EastIdahoNews.com. Thanks, everyone.
Have a great weekend.
And don't forget, if you have questions about the Idaho legislature, you're in luck today because our politics and government reporter, James Dawson, is taking all of your legislative questions all day long today. Here's how you do it. He's going to be on our Instagram stories. So you just need to go and follow at Boise State Public Radio and then send your questions to James and he will answer those for you today. So a big thank you to all of you, our listeners. I wouldn't be here without you. So thank you so much. Our senior producer is Samantha Wright. Our executive producers are Paul Stribling and Tom Michael. Our theme music was written and produced by Boise musician Will Hall. Remember, if you have a question for us or maybe a comment or an idea for the show, email us, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. I hope you have a lovely holiday weekend as we celebrate President's Day weekend. Because of the long weekend, we will be back here on Tuesday. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you next week.